Hello and welcome to Outside In. My name's John Burns, and this is my podcast for folk who like to be outdoors. It started during the lockdown that we had, and to be honest, it's just sort of kept going. My guest today is a man who's written a book that's coming out in a few days' time, and it's something that is quite close to my heart, really, because one of my fascinations, and I think a lot of fascination for a lot of people who go to the hills, is snow. I grew up on Merseyside, and snow was a pretty rare commodity then in that rather urban landscape. But I remember as a small boy seeing a fall of snow and just being in absolute awe at how it transformed the landscape. And I'm basically still in awe. Really, nothing's changed. Now, we think of snow and ice as being a sort of transitory winter experience, but actually there are places in the British Isles where snow and ice are there almost permanently. And my guest today has written a book called The Vanishing Ice, which is about these near permanent ice patches in the British Isles. And his name's Ian Cameron. Hello, Ian. How are you?
Hello, John. Fine. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
You're very, very welcome. I was wondering, so you too must be fascinated by snow. Where did that start for you?
Long time ago, actually. When I was 9 years old, in fact, I remember it quite vividly. The fascination, I suppose you could call it, came from when my family moved to a new house in Port Glasgow, which is a not too salubrious area of Western Scotland. And we had a house which sat about 500 foot up the side of a hill. And it afforded magnificent views, really. And my parents are still in it to this day. But the house has got magnificent views across the Firth of Clyde, reaching across all the hills surrounding the Firth of Clyde. But particularly one big hill, which at the time when I saw it, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what its name was, and I subsequently found out it was Ben Lomond, Scotland's most southerly Munro, which is a hill over 3,000 foot. And on this particular day, which was in May, I saw this big blob of snow persisting on it where it had melted everywhere else. So this fascinated me as to why it was still there. And I did some investigation, found out by looking through an old AA atlas what the hill was. And really that was the beginning, or the spark, as I call it in the book. That was something which flipped a light on for me. And it really was the very first kernel of what has turned out to be a lifelong passion.
Yeah, it's amazing how those early childhood experiences, they sort of sear themselves into you sometimes. Tell us about these snow patches then. Whereabouts are they, and sort of how many are there roughly?
It varies really from year to year, I suppose. The main place, or the two main places in fact, are unsurprisingly on the Cairngorms and on the Nevis range of hills. These are the areas in Britain that have the highest ground, and it's, I suppose, logical for people to understand that the highest ground supports the most amount of snow. The Cairngorms are you would probably call the snowiest place in the UK. It's the area of highest upland above 3,000 foot. You can walk, in fact, for almost 10 miles, in fact, slightly more than 10 miles on the Cairngorms and not drop below 3,000 foot. So it's the area where snow persists the longest, and the Nevis range as well. That includes Ben Nevis, Annachmore, Annachbeg, and Carmore Jerrig. So these are the areas that support the longest lasting patches of snow, specifically in the Cairngorms. Breiriach, the UK's third highest hill, second highest in the Cairngorms. There's a very isolated corrie in there called Garachor Moor, which means the big rough corrie. And contained within this corrie, there are a few patches of snow which, historically speaking, were thought to be permanent, as you alluded to in your introduction. The snows there are are probably the most widely known. They're probably the best studied in the UK, and have become the most famous by dint of them being, I would say, coming to prominence as part of perhaps the research that I and others engage in. They really have become quite well known. So-called Sphinx Patch and Pinnacles Patch are the two most well known. So they sit right in the heart of this isolated quarry of the Cairngorms, Breiriuchs, Garachor Moor. But also on Ben McDoo in Cairngorm, there are patches of snow which, you know, they can survive, not always, can survive. Mm-hmm. Ben McDoo, I think the patches on Ben McDoo, some of them can last through multiple years as well. But really, the Garachor Moor ones on Breiriuch are the ones which last the longest and melt the fewest amount of times. And over in the west, as I say, on Ben Nevis and its surroundings, we've got one in the upper reaches of Observatory Gully in Ben Nevis, which tends to last through many years. And on Annaghbeg, you have one which is a bit of an enigma, which sits at just over 3,000 feet on the northeast face of the hill. And that lasts through many years as well. So those really are the main areas. That occasionally, just occasionally, you have other areas where snow persists. It tends to be quite unusual, particularly nowadays, but Craigmeggy, for example, snow has persisted there relatively recently. Gilharn, near Ben Alder, snow persists there. And very occasionally, maybe once every 20 years or so, we get survivals in the Northwest Highlands up near Loch Malarduch, so Skurnalapich and Riavachan, these sorts of areas. But you know, the areas which have the most snow and where snow persists the longest are the Cairngorms and the Nevis Range.
Okay, yeah, I mean, obviously you've been up and close up and personal with these snow patches. Are these the soft, fluffy snow that we imagine, or are they a bit different from that?
Probably more like glacial ice, to be honest. By the time summer and autumn comes round, the snow has really metamorphosed from as you say, the fluffy stuff, into more like a nevi, you know, a fern. It's really, really hard. And that's because it's gone through a process of change. It's gone through a considerable amount of freeze-thaw. That just means that the pack warms up and cools down many times over summer. And what happens is the pack becomes saturated, the air gets liberated, and then it refreezes, and that process goes on and on and on. Even in summer, you know, in the right conditions, you can get snow freezing up as well. But most of the freeze thaw takes place in winter and spring. But what that does is that gives it an almost concrete like mm-hmm. feel, and the weight of it as well compresses the snow. So when you go to it in summer, and you go into or you go around the back of the snow, which you can often do, you'd really struggle to make a snowball because some of it is really like glacial ice. You can scoop a little bit off the surface and you can, you know, make a snowball with that. But certainly the soft, fluffy snow that people would think of falling on their back garden when they make a snowman, very far from what snow is like after it's been lying on the ground in the Scottish Highlands for the best part of 9 months. So very different.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've seen a few of these snow patches, been up to them in the northern quarries of the Cairngorms, for example. And they seem to be a bit like, I don't know, old warriors after a long, long battle. Because they tend to be scarred by rocks and pulverized and gouged, but they've somehow sort of survived. But it's also the case, is it not, that when you say you can get behind, you can also get underneath these snow patches, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, you can. You can get around the back of them. Because what happens is you have great depth builds up in winter and spring. When I say great depth, some of the very deepest patches of snow, for example, on Ben Nevis, easily can reach 20 metres in winter, sheer depth. Yeah. So what you find is in summer, when that snow starts to melt, it melts away from the quarry headwall, it melts away from the cliff. That's because the rock heats up, it's heated up by the sun, and that starts to radiate out heat itself. So that creates a void between the snow and the rock itself, and it enables the interested party, such as myself and others, to walk into the back of the snow. And that word, we don't have an English word for it. There's a German word which we use, is called Randkluft, which is the space between a snow patch and the cliff face. So, but it's such a little known and little seen phenomenon that there's no English word for it, and certainly not in the UK. There's no word for it. So we've had to borrow the word. But the most impressive part of going to a patch potentially in summer is the tunnel which is carved out. So you can actually go through these patches of snow. Little streams sometimes work their way through the middle of the snow. At the start of summer, you know, when the ground starts to warm up, you have a little stream which bores a small hole, perhaps only a foot or so wide. But what that allows is the passage of air from the top to the bottom. And as that warmer spring and summer air comes through the hole, it gradually expands it until the melting from below meets the melting from above, and you have this incredible tunnel. It's supported on each side by an arch. And that can be a very thin layer, allowing these amazing translucent blues and greens and all sorts of wonderful colours to form. Very well seen on the cover of the book that I've written, with a wonderful photograph from Murdo MacLeod, and it shows all these incredible colours. So it's a really remarkable phenomenon to see it, and you know, not many people get to see it by nature of the fact that these things can be incredibly hard to not only find but to get to. They persist in some of the most difficult terrain that the Highlands has got to offer. So only a very select few get to see these things, but my goodness, what an incredible sight they are.
It sounds, yeah, I mean, I think that's really fascinating that you must be one of only a handful of people really have seen these places, because although people go there, I mean, they're obviously a transitory phenomena anyway. So because of what the other remoteness, how difficult they are to get to, there can't be that many many folk who go there.
A handful.
And quite an experience, really. And what do you think, you know, obviously, well, the climate obviously is warming up, but there's always a slight possibility that if the Arctic, also the Atlantic conveyor switches off, then things yes. will get things could get. There's a slight possibility, an earnest hope in my mind, to be quite honest, that things do get a lot colder. Presumably, how much colder would it have to get before these snow patches became permanent and indeed began to grow?
We're not talking a huge amount. Gordon Manley, who was one of the great snow observers of the last 100 years, he wrote on this, and he postulated when he was writing that a drop of about 2 degrees Celsius averaged out over the year would be enough for sort of little nascent glaciers to form in the highest corries of Scotland.
Right.
And that probably sounds about right. It might be slightly more nowadays, because we have definitely had a little bit of warming since Manley's time, but two degrees doesn't sound a huge amount. I suppose, looking at what's happening around the world just now, you have to say that's very unlikely. But
yeah.
But as you mentioned, you know, if the North Atlantic, the conveyor belt from the warmer waters of the Caribbean, for example, the Gulf Stream, if that were to be affected by climate change and the relatively warm conditions that we enjoy at this latitude were to somehow be influenced or affected or turned off, then it's not outside the realms of possibility that, you know, after 5 or 6 very cold winters and generally cold years, then you could see the return of at least semi-permanent snows back to the UK, or even permanent snows, I should say, back to the UK. So tantalising, but at the moment it looks unlikely.
It's unlikely, yeah. I am talking about a sort of climate disaster.
definitely.
Which, I mean, if it happened, at least I'd have the right socks, you know. But apart from that, I think the chances of it actually happening. And How long did it take you to do the research for this book? Because obviously, you know, it's a huge amount of work traveling throughout the Highlands and exploring these snow patches.
Yeah, for sure. The amount of, as you say, work that went into it was pretty significant, not just for the research and stuff for the book, but the actual, over the course, I suppose, of the last 25 years, the amount of miles I've travelled, the amount of trips I've done, the people I've met, the things I've seen, that's all gone into it, you know. So it hasn't been I've started from scratch. I'm fortunate in that I've been able to draw on a wide body of work and trips, experiences that I've had over the last, I suppose, 25 years. So that has all gone into the book itself. And actually, when I started to write the book, which was just about, I don't know, about a year and a half ago, I guess, a lot of it came quite easily, just because I had done so many trips and I had met so many interesting people, and I think I had so much to tell. And it's not just about Scotland, you know. I do cover parts of the upland areas of England and Wales as well, with some fascinating historical stories which I gathered over the years. So it's not purely about the Highlands of Scotland. We do have I do have some interesting stuff, I think, that I've picked up from my travels around the UK. But you know, the work, as you know, that goes into writing a book is it's all it can be quite daunting. And you know, though I have written and I do write papers for the Royal Meteorological Society, I beg your pardon, every year, this is an entirely different kettle of fish. You know, writing whatever it was, 70,000 words is not a it's not to be sniffed at, you know. So, but I was fortunate because the research that I had done in the last 20 years stood me in very good stead for writing the book.
No, that's great. Nevertheless, it is, as you say, quite a feat. And I've suddenly had this horrible thought that what you might do is you might spoil, like there are Monroe bashers. I think what might come from your book, do you think, are people who are going to take off the snow patches? What do you think?
I think it's so unlikely because of some of the places, some of the places where these things repose. It's just it would take someone very, very dedicated to go to these places. There are for sure likely to be people who think, oh, I quite fancy that. And there are more people going to these than they're used to. However, because of the difficulty involved in getting there, I think it will always be a minority sport. But, you know, I could be wrong, but I suspect not. You know, it's all very well people being interested in this from the comfort of their living room, watching nice pictures on, you know, either some TV channel or in the newspaper or whatever. But the amount of people who are prepared to put their boots on and go up to these places is still pretty small.
Well, let's hope that's the case. My experience is if you create a list, people will follow it.
Yes,
so usually, despite it. Perhaps because it's so difficult. I don't know. You might get a lot of people who finish all the Monroes start doing the snow patches.
Possibly, yes.
I don't know. But I think it's you know, even if I've been sort of flippant, but I think that anything that creates an interest in our mountains and creates an understanding of what's happening to them and the flora, the climate, the flora, the fauna, is good, and I think that if your book takes people's understanding a little bit further, then you'll have done quite a good service. Is there anything that you would like to see come out of this book? Is there something that you'd like to be able to change?
It's a good question. I always preface these things by saying that I'm not a climatologist, and I'm not even an academic for that matter, though I do write academic papers. I'm a what you call a citizen scientist, an amateur. Okay. I do this thing as an amateur. I have a day job, so this is done as a hobby, all unpaid, all off my own back. So I when these sort of questions arise about, you know, either what's behind this, is it man-made climate change, you know, what can we do to change, I'm naturally reticent about answering them, because I don't know enough, and I would feel a bit of a fraud asking people to change their behaviour. However, having said that, the question about what would I like to see from the back at the back of this book is, I suppose, purely from a selfish point of view, I would like more people when they're up doing hill walking, and if they do see snow in summer, is to photograph it and send it to me, because it's very, very useful. It's very useful for research, and the more people who are out doing this, the easier my job becomes in compiling the data, because it means that all the time I'm not having to go out and do it, or people like me. So I suppose that from a selfish perspective, that would be a great thing to come out of it. But yeah, as you said, John, the amount of people that come to understand our flora, our fauna, our hills generally a bit better, or appreciate them a bit more, then if the book helps to do that, then it'll have been a success, I suppose. I'm not, you know, if it happens, it happens. It's great. I'm not arrogant enough to think that this book is going to change the world. However, it's nice, I think, that some of the comments that people already have come back to me with suggest that maybe perhaps they'll, you know, take a bit more care the next time they're out, that they will, you know, photograph this stuff. They'll come back to me with good information and good data. So, you know, if that's all that comes out of it, then I'll be happy enough.
Well, that's fantastic. And I think, you know, I think what you've done is it's a little known area of our, I mean, I suppose one of the things that you've been able to do is to discover something about our mountains that actually, well, perhaps wasn't that widely known. And we know, we tend to think of our hills as being, I suppose, explored to death. But what you've done in finding these places actually is to find some little secret places still untouched, maybe. So I think that's a great thing. And if it does increase people's enjoyment and interest in the hills, all to the good. So, well, thanks very much, Ian. Really good to talk to you. All the very best with your book, which is published, I think, 2nd of September, isn't it?
It is, yes. Thanks very much. I appreciate it, John.
Great. And thanks very, very much, Ian. What we'll do now is Ian's kindly recorded himself reading a short section of the book. So here's Ian Cameron reading from his book, The Vanishing Ice.
This section describes a walk I did in October 2015 to Ben Vrotten in the Cairngorms. 2015 was a very, very snowy year, and lots of patches persisted all over Scotland, but this was perhaps one of the more memorable. Eventually, some 2 hours after parking the bike, I reached the Corrie. Last year's patch of snow sat in a large hollow just below the horizon's edge. Now, on easier terrain, I made for it, noticing a large inverted V carved in its southern edge. I knew immediately what this meant, a tunnel. But this was surely no ordinary tunnel. It was one that had been months in the making. Water and wind had carved it out during the short summer and autumn, and I hurried towards it across good ground. Two ptarmigan took to the air, their winter coats of brilliant white not yet developed. Upon reaching the opening, I peered in excitedly. Snow tunnels are one of the great sights of the Highlands, and I had been at enough of them to know just how wondrous they could be. Even so, seldom had I seen anything like this one in Scotland. I crouched motionless, then dumbfounded. A cold wind, far cooler than the ambient air temperature, passed down through the tunnel and across my face. A coldness that had been laid down some 11 months previously was blowing away with the wind. Mighty pillars of white snow on each side of the small burn supported the most stunning of arches, which ran the full length of the 75-foot-long patch. Translucent blues and whites, caused by thinning snow being pierced by the daylight, lent an otherworldly quality to what would normally be just one of a million anonymous watercourses. The tiny stream's babbling noise offered a lyrical soundtrack to the atmosphere. In addition to the colours of the snow, mosses of luminous green hugged the waterside. Large, pink granite blocks also contributed to the kaleidoscope of colours, which were almost overwhelming. Today, the small stream was not anonymous. It was one of the most beautiful places in the whole of the Cairngorms, and probably the entire country. At least, to me it was. I thanked whichever of the responsible gods that, for this brief window of perhaps a few days, I was fortunate enough to be there and to see the snow before it collapsed onto the stream. Its blocks would dissolve and end up feeding the River Dee, as all precipitation on this hill must ultimately do. In my head, I drew parallels between this scene and when blossom appears on the trees in Japan. An ephemeral window of staggering beauty which disappears as quickly as it comes into being. I drank it all in, unsure if I would ever come to this location again and witness such an exhibition of colour and beauty.